How Hi, are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I miss you.
I miss you too.
You want your mic on? Oh, I thought I was doing this.
I am on this thing here.
Oh, hi, Robin.
Hi.
And so it begins.
Dun, dun, dun.
You know, Carrie, I was telling Bob that when I was in elementary school and I had to read a book and do a book report, I just read the first however many pages, and I'd do the report. It was always an oral report, but I'd always end it with, "And if you want to know more, you'll just have to read the book."
So we read the prologue.
We would like to focus the next hour primarily on the page and a half prologue, which really was just
good, really good
chills.
Good. Let's do that.
Where to start?
That's Carrie Brownstein. This is the music of her band, Slater Kinney. Carrie Brownstein has just written a book. It's called Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. It's a funny, sad, poignant memoir, incredibly well written, and it paints a picture of a Carrie Brownstein we never knew.
I think the number one most surprising thing for me was the picture that you paint of yourself in this book. I mean, you completely tear down and dismantle any perceptions that your fans have or might have of you as an invincible rock star. You consistently describe yourself as shy, superstitious, a little paranoid, anxious, a hypochondriac, and often self-destructive.
That's all?
Well, no, there's more. I wrote
no,
a whole
no,
list
please
of things.
Stop, please stop.
So what, as I was reading I thought, what on earth compelled you to tell everybody about this?
Yeah, why write this?
That's an interesting take on it because it's not vulnerable enough. I've read that a couple times. Like, I don't reveal enough, which is the exact opposite of what you're saying.
Oh, my God.
No, wait a minute. Look,
I'm not even joking.
I know, but I'm going to play this clip.
Oh, so I have to listen to it?
Yeah, it's you. Here we go.
Okay.
All right.
It was time for us to play, but I, for once, couldn't access any reserves. I felt like mush, murky. I was an outsider and outside, undone and unraveled. I started to cry. It was that ugly kind of sadness, of wailing, where your face distorts, lips curl, your features cascade like a waterfall. And then, whack! I punched myself in the face. Over and over, I repeated the motion. Each blow brought the feeling to the surface. The hatred rose up and I hit it back down. I saw the enemy and it was me. I wanted to destroy it. Pow! I couldn't stop. Thud! You fucking fraud! I was in the ring with only myself. Here's your fear. Punch! Here's your anger. Here's every sickness you've ever known. Slap! Here's your powerlessness. Smack! I boxed myself to oblivion.
Just the context, you would just let the band down, not because you wanted to.
In your own mind.
But you got the shingles at this point.
Yeah.
This
we didn't contextualize it. So basically, here I am after years of accumulating anxiety and depression, which are sort of flip sides of the same coin, multiple panic attacks, and then physical illnesses. At this point, shingles, which really affects your nerves, nerve endings. So there's a lot of pain, and we're in Europe, specifically in Belgium. And I basically break down in this kind of nexus of physical and emotional pain and take it out on myself. And to me, when I was writing this book, a story, I think, of going from feeling sort of disembodied to embodied, someone that felt in the margins, to someone who felt a sense of belonging. But there's this writer I love, Charles D'Ambrosio. He's an essayist, and he was talking about why he writes in the process of writing, and he said has to do with the dream of making the distance go away. And so much about that moment that you just played was that dream, the idea that I had assembled versions of what I imagined a family could be, you know, this collection of love and comfort through Slater Kinney, through community. But I still was somewhat a divided self. That moment was a real coalescence of realizing that that architecture that I thought I had built was quite flimsy, and I just kind of broke down.
I would imagine people reading this book know you in their own way. They might not be friends, but it's not hard to think of someone as you do, as you talk about your family life, as you talk about the health problems of your mom and your relationship with your father, and trying to find a way. I mean, you were almost like a stray cat. You'd wind up in other people's homes. They'd take you in. You'd try to find family that way. And then you'd get to go to clubs and you'd find bands and you'd try to find family that way. I cannot imagine anybody reading this book and not feeling some part of them in you in trying to find a home. And then you seem to, for any fan of yours, found this perfect situation. A great band, you could do things pretty much on your own terms, and yet, in the end, there you are. You are depressed and...
Vulnerable
still. And yeah.
Yeah, I think, though, through that vulnerability, you know, eventually that's become a source of strength. And I think I've, which is part of the reason that the book... is revealing, and there is an openness in it, because what kind of started out as a closed fist, I think both in terms of performance and the idea of kind of keeping people, keeping an audience kind of back, you know, through this force. I feel the same sense of that, the same power and empowerment in the band, but, you know, that the hand is now open and reaching and about embracing. So that I think I wanted and was okay with a sense of vulnerability within the book, knowing that actually it's finally the real source of strength and growth from which to set forth.
Does that mean the tours are healthier now? Does that mean working on other projects are healthier?
Absolutely. I think I was so grateful in the years after Sleater-Kinney broke up or went on hiatus, whatever you want to call it, to find Portlandia and co-create Portlandia with Fred Armisen, which allows for levity, allows for the same kind of kinetic energy, but channeled through absurdity and surrealism, which to me is another way of kind of processing murky, confusing information or observations or phenomena. But it definitely is a different, slightly different tool. And then just, I think, getting older and you know, kind of developing a greater sense of compassion, I think, for myself and for others. So yeah, when Sleater-Kinney came back and toured again this year, you know, we treated ourselves really well and put our mental and emotional well-being at the center of that journey. And we had a lot of fun, and it was still very intense. The music never lost any of that intensity, but it was the fulfillment, I think, was really palpable.
I'm just wondering, for anybody who is struggling with identity, trying to find their place in life, the outsiders of the world that you certainly were, and searching for family through music, did it turn out to be the viable path that you had hoped it would be?
I think in some ways, yes, and I still consider it a salvation on many levels and a place of refuge to get into a world of feeling and to, you know, develop these creative partnerships that were very fruitful. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that all, I think, existed simultaneously with, you know, some of the anxiety and depression. I mean, I think one of the scariest things about depression is that it exists along with the happiness and the joy, and it kind of plays with it and sucks the color from it. So I still see all the benefits and of that time in Sleater-Kinney, and it was some of the best times of my life. But there were moments that were colorless, and that's really hard. But I think it still was the right path. It was the place that got me where I am today, no doubt. I wonder where I would have been without that cathartic element and that sense of community.
And here's a beautiful description of your positive attitude as a young fan going to see shows.
I discerned very little between good and bad bands, popular or obscure. Every band was good. Every player had a purpose, was standing his or her ground, contributing, making a sound. Any band was worth buying a single from, supporting, dancing along to. I could find appeal in the sway of a bass player or the cocky head bop of a drummer, in the musculature, in the posturing, in the daring hint of sexiness that you never witness off stage, in a glance or glare, in the reveal of a fang, in a singer's spit in the act of screaming, in sweat forming on a chest or hairlines, in a dropped pick somehow reclaimed mid-song, in a smile between two band members. I saw merit and beauty in it all, and if not beauty, then purpose, or at least just a way of positing yourself in the world, standing in one spot and being heard, etching your name somewhere, even if it disappeared shortly after. But at the time, it all felt permanent, the most permanent and concrete thing I'd ever felt, and I was surrounded. Mostly what I felt was that I wanted to do that too.
I love that description. It really is, when I go to shows, and maybe you still feel that when you go to shows, there's so much to fall in love with. The people next to you, the watching the band, the spit. I love that line, the spit and the scream.
I definitely still feel that, and I really relish my place in an audience. And I think, like you, who sees many more shows than I do a year, part of the experience is the immersion into a group of mostly strangers and that collective awe and a sense of wonder. I really enjoy basking in that. And it's just as interesting to me to watch people performing as fans and observe the different ways that they experience ecstasy or joy or even heartbreak in relation to a song. And I like the undulation in the crowd and, you know, watching people's faces. I really live for those moments, and as much as I live for, you know, hearing the songs that I want to hear. And that's why I really appreciate the live experience, both as a performer and as an audience member, which I know you appreciate too.
Yeah, you can always, and I think you can often tell, and I certainly saw it in your band when I saw you recently, that it's nice to see a band that is also, that are also fans, that they're not lost in their world, that they're just in love with music in general. They like the music they make, but you could just see they love this community they've created on that evening in whatever city it might be.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of bands with longevity, a lot of musicians with longevity, that's what you have. You know, you have that community that you have built up, and you feel protective of it. You know, I think that it's harder to do if you kind of come out of nowhere and everything's sort of reliant on like a radio hit or something. But for bands with longevity and even huge artists, like, they're very aware of that, you know, sense of communion with a group of people. You know, I mean, at the highest level, you see someone like Taylor Swift doing it and really having a grasp on a sense of audience and how fans relate to her. And then you obviously see it on small stages and small rooms. I think those are the bands that really are going to be around a while.
You have one relationship as a fan to bands, but then when the other thing happened, when you have this band and the band forms and you have discover fans and they come up to you, is that the relationship you expected? Do fans understand? You talk a little about this in the book, about the relationship with fans. It's awkward.
Yeah, it's, you know, because I think what everyone fears is that the disparity between who you are on stage or what people project onto you, which are hopes and fears and all versions of their, you know, imagination. Yeah, you know, their own sense of family, their own sense of feeling seen or recognized. And then the difference between that and who you are offstage, which is somebody full of contradictions, flaws, like all of us. I was afraid, and I think many people are, of people noticing that difference, people feeling, you know, that, this person is undeserving of my affection. You know, you hear a lot of people say, I never want to meet my heroes. I feel that way about people. And I think that's kind of a common feeling to think that, because we're kind of aware that, you know, we may not like them as a person, and that might affect how we listen to them or see them. So I think early on, when I had more anxiety, I was really concerned, you know, about feeling fraudulent or less than, and was probably the least social of my bandmates. You know, Janet Weiss, our drummer, she would go out to the merch table and communicate with people, and she's very gregarious, and people love her for that, as they should. I kind of held back, and I think I'm less concerned with that now. And then social media is, of course, a way of kind of mitigating and augmenting this very idea where you can create a version of yourself that's, for the most part, very earnest and communicate with people in a way where they feel where they feel seen, which is, I think, what people want, or to be heard, or to just, you know that you know who they are, which is easier to do now.
You talk about engaging with your fans and meeting the fans, and it reminds me of, there's so many funny moments in this book, but there's a great moment where you and Jack White, when the White Stripes are opening for Sleater Kinney, you decide, you know what, we always get invited to these after parties and we never go, but let's go to this one. You go, and they won't let you into the party.
I know. Someone on Twitter actually just said, we're finding out whose party that was. And I think they figured it out. And some guy said, we came out 5 minutes after you left. We're so sorry.
Oh, that is so funny. But you know, in telling these stories, another one of the myths that you sort of destroy is the glamour of being in a rock band and touring. There's this clip we want to play from the book about what it was like being on the road.
Oh, but by the way, if anybody wants to be in a band, just turn this off. Fast forward 1 minute.
Because you won't want to. Because
it'll end your desire for and your dream.
Tour is a strange beast. What constitutes comfort and cleanliness is relative. In 1996, I was 22. I slept on couches that had been purchased at Goodwill or hauled in from the sidewalk. I made a bed on any number of surfaces with unknown, unsavory provenances. I showered in plastic stalls mottled with mold and borrowed shampoo, toothpaste, and even towels. I never wore slippers. At night, we'd haul in the foam mattress from the van, which we nicknamed PM for pube magnet, since all it did was collect small stray hairs that would be carted back to the van and stick with us for the remainder of tour. In Atlanta, after playing a show during which a gaggle of topless women took over the stage during our set, we ended up at a house owned by a gregarious rockabilly dyke named Rizzo. She must have stayed at her girlfriend's that night because we let ourselves into her house. Inside were two pit bulls, one of which was in heat, bloody towels on the kitchen floor. I slept under a leather S&M-clad mannequin hung from the ceiling in the bedroom. But mostly we slept on floors, rolling out sleeping bags a few inches from one another, no privacy, no distinction between one grimy human shape and another, stinky breath and feet and snores and twitches all merging into a feral pile. It was an endless, slovenly slumber party.
Rock and roll!
Oh my gosh, it's so glamorous.
The Carrie Brownstein story.
And then we got on the Concorde. We flew to Paris.
A feral pile. That is just so, everything about that was just so gross.
It's so gross. Actually, you know, as you mentioned earlier, there's a lot in this book about my dad and some pretty vulnerable stories. But when he first called me after reading the book, this is what he was concerned about. He said, you know, I didn't realize how squalid some of the conditions were.
Squalid.
And he had assumed we were in hotels by then. And it's so funny because as my parent, he was much more worried about the fact that maybe I had slept in some dirty sheets. And I do remember you were so happy. Like if someone's roommate was out of town and you actually had a bed, you would just climb in and the pillows would be, you know, and when you're like 19 or 20, you never wash sheets. So like these pillows would be oily, almost damp. And who knows what had happened? I mean, young people.
They don't know where they've been. Yeah.
Yeah. They probably had sex in this bed. You climb in, you don't, I mean, I just,
but that
I
was slept. The good, that was the, those were the good nights.
Those were the good nights. Right. Yeah. I mean, I remember just so many cockroaches, ants, kitty litter. I remember sleeping so close to a litter box.
Oh. And you're a germaphobe a bit. I mean, the towel line was very funny because the way you phrased that, because of all the things there and somebody's towel, to me that was almost the least, but I know for you as someone who likes to keep it clean.
But, you know, I think part of the reason I like to keep it clean is because I haven't kept it clean. During this time, I wasn't thinking about how dirty it was. It just seemed really, really normal. The person that didn't keep it clean was, we had a guy with us, a roadie, our friend Ryan, and he was a germaphobe, and he didn't shower for 5 weeks because he refused. So you got to figure out what you're going to do. He was disgusting at the end.
That is really disgusting.
Sorry. It's so glamorous being in a band. I mean, gosh, champagne, puppies.
What is the moment that drives it all? I mean, is it just the simple of the 24 hours that you're either driving or feeling scuzzy? Is it really the 45 or 50 minutes that you're on a stage that is really the driving moment? And help people who don't understand help them understand why you do all that for this.
There's nothing else like it. And it is that. It is all worth it for the 45 minutes to an hour and a half. Or if you're an opening band, it is worth it for the half hour. Because there is no other space or moment where it's sanctioned to go to places of such heights or to even express the depths of despair or to mirror madness. It's okay to do that. These are things that you cannot do in your daily life, and you feel your best self. You know, you feel out, it sometimes feels out of body. And even early on, when there are very few people watching or paying attention, I think most people live for that moment when you start to play music. And it's, I mean, it just feels like, well, there isn't a backup plan. This is exactly what I meant to do. It's so scary. It really, I imagine it maybe it's what people feel like when they skydive or something. Like, it is so elating and exhilarating, especially live. It's spontaneous. It may never happen again. And it's weird because the rest of the time is really, really mundane, all of it. But there's just so much beauty in the time you're on stage. It's transformative.
Do you get the same out of different creative aspects? Do you get that out of making films, out of acting, out of writing this book?
Not from writing. I mean, I think the joy is retroactive, you know, in the completion of it. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's Dorothy Parker that said, I hate writing, I love having written. You know, I mean, it's just true. Like, I was so relieved to be done with this book, and I'm very proud of it, and I think it turned out pretty well. But the process of writing it took a lot of discipline and rigor, and just, I didn't feel contentment during it. I think during some performances, shooting with on Portlandia, there's some things that kind of match that onstage experience. But I think it's all a little bit different, and there is something really unique to the physicality of being on stage and hearing your voice at the far edges of a room and the projection, a literal and figurative, of your amplified self.
I think one of the reasons some people do drugs or drink heavily is because they're trying to get away from themselves, right? It's a temporary escape, and it seems like being on stage was sort of your drug, that you were getting away from how you usually were, the more anxious side of yourself. And you even say at one point in the book that music did what you always wanted it to do. It turned you into someone else.
Yeah, it's an allowance of chaos, but it's also a moment where you feel able to steer that and to harness it and to move it through a room in a way that carries other people along with it and yourself. It feels like a magic trick, like you're holding some orb in your hand, and it's all the things you fear and love, and you're like, this, for this hour, I can make this ball of light spin.
That's beautiful.
You talk about chaos. That reminds me of another recurring theme. And I guess, I don't know why, you know, Bob and I have known you to some degree for the past 10 years. Now we've worked together off and on. And maybe it's knowing you a little bit that made some of this surprising. But one of the other things I was surprised by is by how much you like tearing things up. I don't know if I'd say you were self-destructive. It's not like, apart from the moment where you punched yourself in the face, but it's not like you were doing harm to yourself, but you just really liked to stir things up, whether it was dropping out of college or kicking people out of the band or breaking up a band or sabotaging the deal with Matador, the Matador label. I mean, you've moved around a lot. You still move around a lot. And you say in your book, you know, that you talk about the importance of getting out of your comfort zone. And I took this as a really valuable life lesson. Can we play another clip?
We went to the other side of the world to make our own sound. Usually this is a methodology you employ as a restart later in your career. We did it right up front. We traveled to a foreign country for our first record. We had to uproot ourselves, not because we were deep into career ruts or didn't want to give credit to the places we had come from, but because we had no desire to sound like or emulate anything that had come before. It was an extreme way to start, but I learned later on how hard it can become to unsettle yourself, to trip yourself up, and I think that's a good place to write from. It's important to undermine yourself and create a level of difficulty so the work doesn't come too easily. The more comfortable you get, the more money you earn, the more successful you are, the harder it is to create situations where you have to prove yourself and make yourself not just want it, but need it. The stakes should always feel high.
This is a moment as a reader when I come to a book and I take out my pen and I write, true, very true, in the margins of the book.
This is the beginning of the beginning.
Or yes, with an exclamation point by it.
The book here, we're at the very beginnings of Slater Kenny, where you head to Australia, the most likely place for a broke, poor band to go and record. Never been.
So is this like a mission statement in your life to stir things up?
Well, I think for myself, as described in my childhood, I think in those moments where things became unstable and shaky was when I was filled with a force and also forced to improvise, to change, to grow, to find strength. And so I think I have become accustomed to counting on that kind of upheaval to motivate me and to aid in self-discovery or even intellectual curiosity. And so I think I have emulated that as I've gotten older. I think I'm better at controlling it now and making it more deliberate. But I think that being uprooted, feeling the ground kind of move beneath you and not be able to find your footing has always been when I've succeeded the most and forced myself into a trajectory that's helped me create something or helps me innovate or helps me strategize. So yeah, that's, I think it's why I'm sort of a peripatetic person. And I think now though, it's more intentional. Whereas early on, I think I was almost just subconsciously recreating moments of instability.
Do you think that might describe the sound of your band?
Yeah. You mean, you know, something that's...
The earth is shaking a little bit under the feet and it's not, nothing's, you're not really absolutely certain what's going to happen? And
yeah, I think people would describe a lot of Slater Kinney as unsettling. Sometimes when Dig Me Out comes on, like if I'm somewhere and at not usually a restaurant, this is kind of proving my point.
TGI Fridays.
Yeah, TGI Fridays, Ruby Tuesdays. This, you know, like, Dig Me Out, these are records that, you know, it feels like someone is coming out of a speaker and attacking you. Like, it feels like you're being chased down by this rabid song. And that's very propulsive, and I think it can motivate you in one way, but it also, it's hard to kind of sit back with that. It is a very unsettling sound.
When you and Korn started making music together, I remember there's a moment in the book where you talk about just sort of tuning up and realizing that everything she did was about a step and a half down, which means that the normal place that you might have tuned your guitar and the place where she would be singing and playing her guitar had a natural tension that you actually wound up keeping and really was part of who you were.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so, we tuned down to from standard E to C sharp.
So let me play this clip real quick about how you and Corin started working together.
Despite the no-frills approach to recording, the songwriting on Call the Doctor brought in characteristics that came to define our sound. On the title track, Corin and I each sang a melody on the chorus. She was louder than me, so her vocal was the lead by default, but we never really considered one a background part to the other. It was a conversation we were having. She had her perspective and I had mine. Or I was emphasizing her point, retelling it even as I was singing along with her. And our guitars did the same thing, augmenting and counteracting each other. We would get to the chorus, and intuitively you'd think this is the time for us to all sing together, and there should be a cohesion, but instead we would split apart. It was almost an anti-chorus. We weren't trying to form a solidarity with anyone but ourselves. Could you sing along to Slater Kinney? Sometimes, but we just as likely shout over you. And good luck trying to sing along with Corin. Trust me, I know. It's nearly impossible.
I also thought of all the poor fans who probably ever tried to listen to your songs and learn how to play them and like, what are they tuned to? What is this? What chord is this?
Because... Yeah, and now I'm privy to people's YouTube videos playing along, and because they haven't adjusted their tuning, yeah, the lexicon of it is kind of difficult to crack. And also, again, because we're not always playing traditional chords, especially on those early records, like the Hot Rock. When we went back this year to try to learn some of those songs, I was even at a loss. It's really hard to figure it out.
I was thinking about a lot of your travels to record stores back in the old days, where they gave you two records by the band Television. And I think of the back and forth that Richard Lloyd and Tom Verlaine had, that dialogue that they had, or the Gang of Four records that you talked about with Andy Gill and...
John King? Or
yes. The conversations they had really put to me a context for what I'd never really thought about your music, the way you and Corin worked together.
Yeah, those were very indelible and influential albums for me, for sure. Both the Television albums and Corin, for her too. I remember listening to Entertainment by Gang of Four a lot before we wrote Dig Me Out. And I can hear that influence mm-hmm. pretty heavily on that record.
You start out with the sound and everything's new and fresh. And you and Corin try to find a sound, and then Janet is there and you have this cohesive thing. And you talk about the possibilities of, or how easy it is to sort of get lazy, how bands, when they get comfy or rich or whatever it is, it's so easy to lose the edge of who you are and why you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so when you go and make The Woods, Corin's at this place in life where she's got a child, she's settled. I can think of the time when I was an early father, and I wanted things to be much more settled and not so, like, I don't want the ground being pulled out from under me. It's okay.
Absolutely.
There's enough chaos going on.
Yeah.
I want sunshine and rainbows, but that wasn't nothing new there. But I love how you and Janet push her, and there's a passage that you write about making The Woods. You're in Casadega, upstate New York. It's not far from Buffalo. It's snowy. You're in a studio. Dave Fridman's your producer. Let's hear what Carrie had to write here.
Now Janet and I were doing a lot more of the songwriting while Corin was busy with family. We had to push her, and she was reluctant to be pushed. Slater Kinney were making our scariest record, and Corin was a mother with a young kid. It was natural that in that realm, in parenthood, she wanted to ward off and protect her kin from horrors, to bring light and happiness into her world. Yet Janet and I were really embracing harshness and leaning into something sonically and thematically dark. We felt there was a creeping tepidness in music, a cloying softness, as if music were only a salve, not an instigator. Janet and I wanted this record to have teeth. Corin didn't quite feel the same intensity at this point. There was tension. When Corin finally got there, especially vocally, she went way out there, but I feel like we shoved her. On the chorus of Let's Call It Love, she sounds mad and desperate, longing and lost. We tossed her out into the ether, and you can hear her singing her way back. The notes are carrying her, but it's not pretty. It's the sound of someone fighting against herself and against her doubters, who in that moment happened to be in her own band. I think the woods turned out exactly how we wanted it, but the process was very painful.
Yeah, the process was really painful. I was actually, as I was listening to that, thinking that, so I'm talking about a song called Let's Call It Love, which is the penultimate song on the album. And there's a long jam session, and then it goes into a slower song. But Let's Call It Love has one of the most insane choruses. You know, Corin is like a banshee at that point. And as I was listening to that clip, I remembered that that's when her family came to visit. So it was just me and Janet and Corin for a couple weeks. And then her husband and son came out, and they, we'd all been staying at the same house, and they kind of went over to the guest house and kind of had a semblance of a nuclear family, trying to normalize as much as possible this very isolated, wintry recording experience that had been pretty desolate and definitely cold, literally and figuratively. And I kind of can't believe that that is a song that she had to do in the midst of trying to, like, have a normal... This is also right before the holidays, you know? So it's like, like 2 weeks from Christmas, and she's got her son and husband there, and we're like, yeah, hey, can you sing this crazy part? And nope, that's not crazy enough. Nope, nope, one more time. You know, I mean, it was a long night. It's one thing to push yourself. It's really intense to try to push someone else.
Was that you and Janet pushing her, or are you saying that, or was that Dave Fridman who was?
That was all of us, you know? It was, and that's, I think it was also the first time, just to contextualize it a little bit, that we'd really worked with someone who had a very strong point of view as a producer. And we wanted that strong point of view, but we were... I wouldn't say we were reluctant at first. We just were kind of unfamiliar with that process. And he wanted to put an imprint on this album, which he very much did. And so he was pushing Corin too. And I think I remember when I did my vocals for Entertain, Corin was not there. Again, her family was around while we were recording vocals, so she wasn't always in the studio. And Dave and Janet and the assistant engineer. Or actually, I think it was just the neighbor kid. He wasn't the assistant engineer. He was like a kid that brought us venison jerky. I'm giving him like a huge credit on the album all of a sudden. Anyway, they were in the room when I did this, you know, really intense vocal take on Entertain. And everyone was like, ah, that's so great. And Corin came in and heard it. And she was like, I mean, you just sound like so, I don't understand what the big deal is. Like, you just sound so angry. And that's not even in the book, but I mean, I remember that very intensely and feeling like I had disappointed her, and also just realizing, like, whoa, we're in really different places right now. And, you know, like 2 days later, that Entertain vocal take didn't even sound that intense, but wow, it was just we were just in such disparate places. And we all loved how the album turned out, but there was a corrosive quality to it.
It sounds like you're talking to, I mean, you could be talking about your immediate family.
That's right.
You know.
Or friendships and relationships and bands. All that stuff changes over time because people change. And that's often the reason that families can't stand one another. It's why people and friends, I don't know.
It's why I had to, I asked if I could move my desk away from Bob's.
That's right.
It's like I am literally going to leap over this desk and squeeze the life out of you if I don't move. I just want to say, as an aside, by the way, there are so many wonderful little moments throughout this entire book, memories that you share from your childhood. And during this recording session for The Woods, you talk about, you know, cooking together and sleeping together. together and going for hikes in the morning and
in the snow. Yeah.
And I just, those moments were all just so beautiful and really wonderful.
Set you up for those other moments.
Yes.
And now, as you said, at one moment, we're going to yank the rug out from underneath ourselves. And,
yeah, there are respites in the book from the darker passages. And there was so much glee and happiness in Slater Kinney. And I think that comes through, you know, whether it's the three of us during the recording of Dig Me Out, and we're literally snowed in and, to the woods. I guess we really function well in snow.
It's quiet. It's easy. It's you have more time and space to think.
Imagine how loud a band like Slater Kinney sounds in the dead-end landscape of snow.
That's awesome.
People wondering what is going on in there as they're dog sledding by.
Yes.
Go ahead, Mike.
I was thinking about the different places in life that you have all been, and you highlighted in when you did The Woods with, you know, a family and a child, so different than the differences and struggles that you were going through, and then the band breaks up, and then you get back together again. But can you continue seeing yourselves as you get older, the three of you, Janet and Corin and you, still doing something like this?
That's such a good question. I won't mention the band, but I went to a show recently, and it was a show where they had, you know, had some hits, but they're also a really well-respected band, and they're older now, and there's
a 401k tour.
Yeah, the 401k tour. And you know, I was just watching the singer interact with the audience, and I could tell, because I've been up there, that there's a self-consciousness that develops when you kind of know, like, when instead of looking down at, I think, what used to be for them a bunch of adoring teenage fans, and all of a sudden it's, you know, like a guy with a, you know, microbrew, and they're the same age. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy kind of knows, well, I guess I have to reach my hand up and try to touch his belt, you know, and hands his beer to his wife, reaches up and touches the belt. And the singer's like, I guess I got to reach down and touch his hand. And I don't know, I just was aware. I felt very hyper aware of that moment and the transparency of that interaction and how I could see the bones in it. And I really thought, like, wow, there's certain, you know, you have to believe in yourself up there. You have to kind of, there has to be an element of mystery that everyone can kind of cohere around in order to really perform our jobs as audience and performers and bands. And there is something, I think, when there's starts to be a juxtaposition, you know, between the nature of the music and sort of what people believe you to be or what you believe yourself to be. And so it all has to do with feeling relevant and
not nostalgic.
You know, I think of someone like Nick Cave, because he's a great example of someone that's still making really heavy music, and or Swans. You know, there are ways, I think, of moving through the world with a feistiness or a irascibility, with volume, where, you know, it doesn't feel like the audience wants you to be laying back in an easy chair. But it really depends on what your willingness is as a musician, as a creator. You know, you have to create the right shape for yourself, because if you create the wrong sort of context in which to exist, and then try to get up on stage and perform that, I think that disconnect could be very uncomfortable to watch.
It's sad.
So I think we'll continue if we have something to say, and if Slater Kinney's the right place to say that. And I have a feeling we'll do more writing for sure.
That's sweet. Thank you for this.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Carrie. I also told you when we were texting briefly that all the stuff with from your memories from childhood, and also talking about your family, and it made me reflect so much on my own relationship with my kids, and I really appreciated that, and I just really missed you at the end of this book. So I hope we can all do something again sometime in the future.
I hope so too. I like you guys a lot, and thanks for this great interview.
Thanks. It was really lovely to talk to you again.
Same here.
Great
all right,
book.
Take care.
Bye.
You too.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
So that's Carrie Brownstein. The name of the book is Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. Well, not me, but it makes...
Right, no.
You don't want to see that.
I can't. And also, I just want to say, I can't overstate how masterfully written this book is. Yeah. It is just a beautiful read.
Great work, Carrie. For NPR Music, it's All Songs Considered.